Hi, I'm Moji Alawodeyau from the Feminist Buzzkills Live Pod, the only podcast that helps you navigate the news in this post-pro anti-abortion hellscape. Each week, with co-host Liz Winstead, we dissect all the news from that sketchy intersection of abortion and misogyny with providers and activists working on the ground. The cherry on top is we have amazing comedy guests who help us laugh through the rage. Feminist Buzzkills Live drops Fridays wherever you pod. Listen and subscribe, because when BS is popping, we pop off.
It's no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi there, I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
And I'm Karen Greenberg.
And this is another edition of the Spy Talk podcast. We're going to be talking today with Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, who has lots to say about how the Trump administration is or is not going about its conflict with Venezuela, in particular deadly strikes without warning on boats suspected but not proven to be running drugs. In the meantime, what's on my mind today, among many other things going on in the intelligence space, is the funeral of former Vice President and Defense Secretary Dick Cheney. I think he's got a lot to account for at the pearly gates, but his passing deserves recognition because I think Cheney, as much or more than anyone else over the last 25 years, transformed U.S. intelligence to pursue terrorists outside what were once legal guardrails. And that transformation is with us today in regard to the Trump administration's operations against Venezuela. Mike?
Well, yeah, you one could add to that the war in Iraq, which was a Dick Cheney special, something he pushed, promoted, and engineered from the get-go in the Bush administration, promoting extremely faulty intelligence to justify it. But I want my item for this week is the extraordinary open arms greeting to Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. Under Donald Trump's first term, the U.S. intelligence community determined that he authorized and approved the operation that led to the brutal butchering of a Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi. And after that, Saudi Arabia was proclaimed by many a pariah. People were pressured to cut all ties to the Saudis. MBS was clearly the critical figure who was an authoritarian leader who was murdering a dissident. And here we are, 5 years later, and open arms greeting. President couldn't have been more warm and enthusiastic about MBS. And I just want to read something that appeared in a Washington Post thread among former Washington Post reporters who were writing about this. Back in 2018, when Khashoggi was butchered, Jeff Bezos was one of the staunchest supporters of the newsroom's efforts to find out what had happened. He started a Khashoggi Fellowship for dissident writers. At the one-year anniversary of Khashoggi's death, he flew to Istanbul for a vigil outside the Saudi consulate where Khashoggi was last seen, even spoke at that event, telling Khashoggi's fiance, "We're with you." That was before Amazon got huge in Saudi Arabia, building warehouses and a data center and locking up a $5 billion AI partnership with the government. So maybe it won't shock you to learn who attended Trump's dinner at the White House, honoring the man who orchestrated Khashoggi's murder. Yep, It's Mr. We're With You himself, Jeff Bezos.
Disgusting, really. So the felon welcomed the assassin. What do you have to say about that, Karen?
There's a headline for you.
I want to go back to what you were both talking about before, about noticing, you know, what the war on terror and as much of it was led by Dick Cheney in terms of the American response actually meant for today. Because this idea of working outside the understanding of the law, particularly by relying upon the OLC memo, which we will talk about in this upcoming episode, it was taken to new proportions in the war on terror, whether it was justifying torture, justifying detention, and justifying certain kinds of presidential power. The other thing he did was to create a presidency that we're now living with in terms of the powers of the presidency to cancel out other parts of the government, including the ability to declare war by giving him blanket authority to declare war. So I just want to mention that.
Worth mentioning, for sure.
And I have a very small story, but I think it's important, which is that CBS is reporting that Border Patrol has a unit that I haven't noticed before called the Predictive Intelligence Program, which is for monitoring the comings and goings of people in their vehicles, using these kind of, you know, hidden cameras and a variety of things, whether they are construction, construction cones or garbage cans or whatever they are, to monitor people. And what are the legal authorities for that? And what is the justification for that? And who are they monitoring? And what are they doing with the information? We're right back where we started years ago when we had this massive surveillance program. And I think this is really interesting when we're watching at the same time the attempt to dismantle the FBI and some of its intelligence capacities and what's happening in the country.
My first reaction is we're all becoming Chinese. I mean, this is reminiscent of, you know, the Chinese facial recognition omni-police state. This will certainly be challenged in court. You can see that one coming from a mile away.
Yeah, but how long has it been going on?
Who knows? And who knows what the intelligence agencies are doing in terms of gathering intelligence on Antifa. You know,
which doesn't exist,
whatever that is.
That would be a very interesting intelligence assignment. You know, the first mission would be identifying who its leaders are, and it doesn't have any. Anyway, let me tell you a little bit about our featured guest today, Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island. He's not just another armchair general in Congress. He actually graduated from West Point and served several years on active duty, including as an Army Ranger and paratrooper. So he's a tough guy. But he topped his military service by going to Harvard Law School, followed by a few years in private practice before starting his political career in Ocean State politics, then winning a seat in Congress, and finally, in 1996, winning a seat in the U.S. Senate. So let's do bring him on. Senator Jack Reed, welcome to Spy Talk. It's great to have the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee with us today. First question, what do you think about this call by a number of your fellow military and intelligence veterans in Congress, all Democrats, urging service members not to follow illegal orders, whatever that means, we're not sure. And of course, Trump is done his performance thing, saying they should be tried for treason and hung.
Right.
Where do you stand on that? You're against the treason and hanging, I assume.
Yes, the first principle you learn really in the military, and I joined the Army at age 17, is you must support and defend the Constitution, and you cannot follow legal laws.
Right.
And that is a lesson that's drummed into you consistently throughout your military service, you know, and that's why we require legal counsel to review military actions, military activities before they're conducted, if possible. But there's a strong sense in the military of respect for the law of war, which says you do not violate the laws and rules of combat. And so, I mean, they're just stating what should be obvious to everybody in the uniform of the United States.
Are you particularly talking about the orders attacking the suspected drug boats coming out of the Caribbean and the Pacific?
No, my reference is to in general. I mean, this is not a passing fad or a recent law. This is fundamental to the rules of law that have evolved over centuries. So that, you know, the Geneva Convention set standards that did not formally exist internationally, but those standards we abide by. And we have our own combat considerations and rules of engagement. And then the international community, which we respect and we accept their laws, has principles that we have to follow.
Right.
And frankly, you know, particularly the higher you go up in ranks, the more you are instructed about the laws of war and how you have to observe them and follow them. And you would think at the very highest levels of our government, they would be very sensitive to doing everything possible to comply with the laws of war, both domestically and internationally.
Were you asked to sign that statement?
No. Just the principals who were involved in the initial public discussion. My comment, again, is consistent. If you had asked me, you know, 25 years ago or more, when I was commanding a parachute company in Fort Bragg, you know, should soldiers follow the law? Yes. Should they violate? No, they can't do that.
I mean, Senator, if you were asked, would you have signed that letter?
I would have had to read the letter and to see what precisely it says, because, you know, I would certainly reinforce this notion that an individual soldier, say the Marine, cannot violate the laws of war or the laws of the United States. That I would sign easily.
So when Trump says, as he did in his Truth Social posting, seditious behavior from traitors, 3 exclamation points, lock them up, and then follow up, seditious behavior, all in caps, punishable by death. What do you make of that?
Well, it's to be very diplomatic, it is kind of not only inflammatory, but it misconstrues entirely the law that soldiers, sailors, et cetera, operate under. And two, the recognition that my colleagues are simply reinforcing what is not only the international law, but is so close to our Constitution and our laws. Again, these off-the-wall statements via X throughout the day are not, I think, in many cases, thoughtful nor accurate. And this is another example.
Can I ask you, do you think that there's a chance that this could have an impact? That if the military, through at the leadership, but also in the ranks, seem to protest enough, strongly enough, and get enough public support for it, that it could actually be a successful pushback? Or do you think that largely this is just staking out some ground and that the powers that be are just too powerful for this to make a difference?
No, I think what will happen is that behavior which officers or senior enlisted people are really troubled by eventually emerges in the public, either through talking to someone else and they say something, or, you know, we've seen these episodes before in our country. You know, my lie was in the Vietnam era when I was beginning my military career. And, you know, there were reports of individual soldiers reporting up that their commanders had told them to do things that they honestly thought were, they knew were illegal. And that word got out despite the levels of command trying to keep it under wraps. And finally, it broke through and, in fact, Callie, the major perpetrator, was convicted of crimes. I remember at the time the commander of that division had moved on and was a superintendent of West Point when I was a cadet there. He was relieved and retired because you cannot do the things they did there. And so this is the president. I don't know. He didn't pay a lot of attention, I think, to Vietnam. He was golfing a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, the situation is such that this is something that is just central to our military ethic. follow the Lord. And my colleagues were repeating it. You could go and, well, you shouldn't have said it that way. You should have said it differently, et cetera. You can always criticize anybody for anything. But what is really concerning to me is the president elevating it to a level where he's basically certainly not discouraging someone taking lethal action against colleagues or members of Congress. That is just preposterous and ridiculous. I mean, frankly, it's just, you know, unacceptable. I'll just stop there.
Senator, the essence of what the what your colleagues were saying was telling people in the armed forces and the intelligence community to refuse illegal orders. Now, we've had in the last weeks, some 83 people killed during 22 strikes by the U.S. military, man bombers, Reaper drones with Hellfire missiles, killing people who are suspected drug traffickers, but we don't know if they really were. There's no evidence of who these people are. Are the people who are being asked to carry out these missions following illegal orders, in your view?
Well, the question of the legality of the operations is something that's been discussed openly by many legal scholars, and many of them conclude that the legality is suspect. And the possibility exists that these are extrajudicial killings. We are trying to probe from the Senate perspective. It's our job. But I must say we're getting very little cooperation from the administration.
Have you seen the Office of Legal Counsel opinion that justifies these missions?
I have. And it's classified. And it would be inappropriate for me to talk about.
Did you find it persuasive?
I like most legal documents, I came away with lots of questions. I won't claim to be a lawyer, but I did go to law school. So I walked out of there with questions. I think we all walked out of there with questions. But, this is one of the procedural roadblocks they're throwing up against the Congress, both sides there, Republican and Democrat, about having, I think, a very important and necessary discussion of what they're doing. Is they claim it's classified and you can't do this. We have requested repeatedly documents that are legally, we're entitled to, not only entitled, but they're asked to give them to us, and many of them have not appeared. There is a consistent campaign by the administration, Department of Defense, to shut out the entire Congress from these operations, including, and it's not just partisan, Republicans as well as Democrats. And we have to, fight back on that. And, for example, one thing we did do is Senator Wicker, the chairman of the committee, and myself sent a letter requesting a series of documents. We're still waiting for a response. But, we have tried in a bipartisan way to essentially do our job, which is to oversight of the military of the United States to see if they're following the law.
But if you keep trying and you submit these letters and you don't have the facts, you don't have the information, and there's no public discussion of the law, for example, about the OLC memo, what's the next step? What's plan B if you keep being, shut down?
The next step is, one, is beginning and to speak very seriously to all of my colleagues, including Republicans, about the need for hearings, the need for the declassification of certain documents, the need to go ahead and carefully, without compromising classified sources, talk about the strategic and the tactical errors that are being made. For example, we are concentrating a huge portion of our Navy in the Caribbean. There is no military threat from Venezuela or Colombia to the United States. And there are serious threats in the Middle East, in Ukraine, in the Pacific. From a strategic standpoint, it does not make a lot of sense to do what they're doing. In addition, in terms of looking at this as sort of a law enforcement operation and curtailment of drugs, even that does not make sense. We have, and we're continuing, a very successful interdiction program in which Coast Guard, a law enforcement agency, stops these vessels, sometimes with the support of the Navy and overhead assets, and they're getting a lot of cocaine coming out of those areas. We also, if we really wanted to look hard at this, is to know how do we place sanctions? Do we go ahead and try to disrupt their financial underpinnings? Much more effective. And what we're hearing, too, is that there was a slight disruption around September, but cocaine consumption in the United States seems to be unaffected at this point.
Cocaine consumption or cocaine trafficking to the United States?
Well, I think that they're related. I know there's a relationship there, but the point in terms of this, also in terms of if the goal is to reduce the consumption of cocaine and resulting deaths, which more deaths are associated with fentanyl, then you've got to use all your tools. I don't see first of all, I think all their cuts and proposed cuts to healthcare systems are going to deny many Americans who use that to kick the drug habits and to stay alive. And they're doing that without any real consideration about those effects. And in addition, all of this money that's being put into immigration is taking away other missions from the Department of Homeland Security, which could be focused more appropriately on drug interdiction or drug cooperation with local authorities, et cetera. So this is not a strategy to, stop cocaine from flooding into the United States. This is a part of a much larger strategy, which is, I think, profoundly wrong, which is we're going to allow the world to become spheres of influence. We're going to let the Russians, essentially do what they want to do in Europe, okay? China, well, yeah, but et cetera. We're going to focus our emphasis on the Americas, which there is not a military threat of the same level.
We have to step away for a sec. We'll be back shortly.
History is messy. It's weird, wild, and anything but boring. Rainy Day Rabbit Holes is a history podcast about unhinged stories that make you stop and ask, wait, is this real life?
From crazy disasters and tasty scandals to enlightening and surprising heartwarming tales, we explore the moments where people behave badly and sometimes beautifully.
We've got naughty politicians, cultural chaos, and a deep love for the Pacific Northwest, including Bigfoot.
It's thoughtful, irreverent, occasionally serious, and always entertaining.
Let's fall down the rabbit hole.
MSW Media.
Okay, we're back. I want to go back to this question of what the administration is telling you and not telling you. Did you say that Republicans also are not getting fully briefed by the administration on what is
doing?
That's
my impression, yes.
And before, there were complaints about not getting intelligence briefings from the administration at the Senate Intelligence Committee. Is that still the case for Democrats at armed services? You're not getting full briefings on what's going on?
We're getting briefings, but they're not, I think, as informative, deliberately not informative. I think there's a lot of questions that are being avoided. And I know for a fact their documentation that we require by law is not coming. And
such as what? What?
Well, we have XORs, which are the orders, essentially, that we require by statute to be given to us within a limited period of time. Some of them have been given to us. Others have been given, which are just basically, let's say, not particularly detailed.
Generic.
Yeah.
So, Bob, bottom line, what is your understanding of what the goal here is from Trump's comments? It appears it's regime change. He said Maduro's days are numbered. I mean, what is the goal? Is it an invasion?
Well, frankly, I don't think they have a goal. A lot of this is sort of seat of the pants. I think a lot of it, too, was how do we make an impression of our lethality and our military prowess, et cetera, literally against an opponent that has no significant military capabilities. You know, this is a way to distract, I think, in some cases, from other issues. Now they're down there, and you know, what's the next step? I think they're discussing that right now in the White House. But this did not start out with a clear strategy.
That's right.
If it had a clear strategy, it would have been comprehensive, including demand reduction. What's the best way to stop traffic? Well, that's interdiction. It's not just shooting up some speedboats. So it's very difficult to predict the strategy from this administration because they don't think, I believe, in any sort of strategic dimension.
Do you think there's frustration on the part of Republicans about all of this? I mean, the not getting information, right? The not being able to know what the legal justifications are in a more widespread manner. Do you get a sense that there's like an increasing sense of frustration about the president and the kind of authorities that he's, exhibiting?
Yes, I think there is. I mean, I think the consequences are growing very significant. They were from the very beginning. I mean, attacking and killing people is a very critical situation. But now, as was pointed out, is now we've got, you know, a fleet in the Caribbean. What are we going to do then? Are we going to invade Venezuela? There's been reports in the press of covert action has been authorized. What is that? You know, what's the legal justification for that? All of that is very ambiguous.
Well, a clue might come from John Bolton, our friend over at Puck. Julia Yaffe asked John Bolton, the former national security advisor, of course, you know, what do you think Trump is up to? What is he thinking? And Bolton said, I think he thinks about what will make him look tough, but he doesn't think much beyond that. He never does think beyond that.
I think that really might capture this particular moment. You know, again, Venezuela is not a military threat. And why wouldn't you just accelerate the interdiction process, devote more assets to it, make a major effort on demand reduction if you were serious about a goal? I think this, in fact, on my sense, has been that, you know, they looked around for somebody that has no real military prowess vis-a-vis the United States, and they concocted this kind of operations to stop, you know, et cetera, because it would, in fact, he could boast about how tough he was, and, you know, he's taken on those narco traffickers, et cetera, and, you know.
It's his movie.
Now we're in a situation where I think, and again, some of this might be not the president making these decisions, but other people making decisions, and he kind of just goes along with it. I don't see a really coherent, tight organization structure in this White House.
Was there a coherent, tight argument in the OLC memo?
I would love to tell you, but I reject classification. That's why I hope we can get a consensus on is a request to declassify the legal material because it doesn't, again, it's legal theory.
Senator, the president welcomed with open arms this week Mohammed bin Salman, the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, berated a reporter for having the impertinence to ask a question about his role in ordering the murder of a Washington Post journalist, Jamal Khashoggi, and announced the sale of F-35s to the Saudis. Your reaction to the open arms greeting, warm greeting at the White House of the president to MBS and the sale of the F-35s, our advanced fighter planes.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, the president has a rather grand style about everything he does, including destroying the East Wing and building a big tribute hall. So that's not surprising to me in terms of the welcome. you know, MSB has become a transitional figure in our relationship with authorities. You know, previously it was a very, it was the home of Islam and very, very committed, et cetera. I think the MSB has made some steps to modernize the country, et cetera. But the issue, I think, of the F-35s is I share the concerns that were articulated by some of our intelligence community that because of the relationship with the Chinese, there could be a compromise of some of our systems on that. And we have to take extraordinary steps to prevent that in collaboration, obviously, with authorities. But yet we don't want this technology to leak out. And that's one concern I have. The other concern is, you know, the business arrangements between the Trump family and the Saudis are such that you, unfortunately, and I never had to deal with this issue with any previous president I've served under, is this connected in somehow to preferential treatment with respect to economic deals, investments, et cetera? That clouds the whole situation, too. And it also goes back to the initial point about this grandiose welcoming ceremony. Was that kind of business development or was it foreign policy, which is, you know, a tough business. And sometimes you have to sit down with people who, you know, don't always follow the righteous path. But, you know, you've got to talk and you've got to deal, et cetera.
Speaking of business deals. There's been people around the administration, around Donald Trump from the get-go of the first administration who wanted to bring nuclear power to Saudi Arabia. What's going on there? The problem was always, or the worry was always that, of course, they could go from peaceful nuclear power to a weapons program. Do you worry about that? I suppose you do.
We do. We have to consider that. Again, there's a possibility of creating an arrangement in which all of the nuclear material used and about to be used is under control of the United States. And the facility is located there, but the control of the nuclear components are still within the United States. That's something that's been discussed. You know, the first administration, yeah, they were pushing to get nuclear power, you know, in there. This, I haven't sensed the same kind of push. The other interesting thing is the Saudis have been investing significantly in alternate energy, solar, wind, you know, and here's the largest producer perhaps in the world, or one of them, of oil and petroleum. And they're heavily into alternate energy forms because I think they see the future and they're covering all their bets. And we're at the same time deliberately taking away our alternate fuel generation capabilities.
It's nuts.
It is crazy. Yeah.
Let me shift the focus a little bit if I can. We're called Spy Talks, but we're very interested in intelligence issues. Your colleague over at Senate Intelligence Committee, Senator Warner, it's going to deliver a speech tomorrow. They're very much ballyhooing it about the politicization of intelligence. Do you see that leaking into the Defense Department?
I've already given my speech on the politicization of military. It's real. It is very real. And it's causing a lot of concern to particularly retired officers and scholars who've looked at the military. Yeah, I've seen this track of politicization from the very beginning, in little and big detail. You might recall, or might not, but when President Trump went up to address the graduating class at West Point, he wore a MAGA cap. You can't wear political paraphernalia on military posts, particularly the President of the United States.
What about the intelligence component? The Defense Department is the biggest collector of intelligence we have.
Yeah.
Do you worry about politicization of NSA or the Defense Intelligence Agency? What evidence have you seen of that?
I've seen a great deal of evidence. The head of the Defense Intelligence Agency was dismissed after he supported the analysis of his colleagues in saying that the attack in Iran did not end or obliterate their nuclear capability. It did set it back. And then within a matter of weeks, he was dismissed. And that's just a clear-cut example of, you know, don't give me intelligence, give me what I want to hear. And that's the path to disaster. And it sends a signal, too, throughout the intelligence community. General Hawk, who is commander of Cybercom, one of the most competent and dedicated officers I've ever met, was dismissed because Laura Loomis showed up and said, you know, get rid of him, which is not the way to judge the character and the confidence of a military officer. And he was let go. And that sent a message too, like, okay, don't do what he was doing. I.e., he was a professional officer giving his best advice. You know, you saw that with the dismissal of the General Brown, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, not based on merit. He was a quite capable chairman, and it was just many other factors. And, you know, they went through the ranks and dismissed Admiral Franchetti, CNO, Admiral Fagan, who was commandant of the Coast Guard, two women. And I think that played a role in the dismissals. You've seen other dismissals that make no sense from a professional standpoint, but do from this standpoint of, I just want people around that are going to do what I say and never question it. And I want people who look the part, which I would never have gotten a job, 6 feet tall and, you know, can do 10,000 push-ups.
But wait, I want to push. I just want to look down. Is there really no discussion of what to do to fight back as these people just keep getting dismissed and dismissed and dismissed or forced to resign, as we've seen? Is there nothing that feels right or proper or effective?
Well, no, pushing? I felt I had to go to the floor and had to make it clear. And I've repeated many of the things I mentioned on the floor of the Senate, that this is a very critical issue which can't be ignored. I will go back again. I'm trying to enlist colleagues on both sides of the aisle because it were more effective that way. In fact, that's the way we really get things done. And then there are also outside retired officers or experts in military strategy and policy who are beginning to speak up too. But you know, we just have to keep the pressure on, and I'm trying, but we're in the beginning stages. And I, again, it's an issue that is very close to, you know, I started in the service at 17. It's very close to me personally, but also it has a tremendous possibility of taking what is the world's greatest military organization and turning it into an instrument for the president. Deploying these National Guardsmen into our cities is unnecessary, unwarranted. And I think he's signaling other things beyond immigration. It's like, hey, we can go into your city anytime we want. Yeah, don't bother us or do what we say.
Senator, have you seen the new movie, A House of Dynamite, about a stray missile that escapes our defenses and heads to Chicago?
Yeah, I saw a third of it, and I tried to return in the evening. I couldn't get on to the streaming service, but I've seen a third of it. It's an excellent movie.
Yeah, so your thoughts, I mean, people watching it could really worry about the state of our nuclear defenses.
The state
of
our president.
Does this implicate, you know, more money expenses to beef up those? Or are there other things we should be doing to make sure this kind of thing never happens?
Yes, there are. And I must commend my predecessor, Sam Nunn, and Ernie Moniz, the former Secretary of Energy. They have been leading an effort to enhance fail-safe, enhance those. And that requires setting up communications with not just the Russians, but also the Chinese, who are beginning, I think, to do that. But to basically have a way to communicate if a mistake is made or if there's a unauthorized launch or something like that. So at least the nuclear powers understand what's going on, and they can make better decisions. I mean, the House of Dynamite, basically, they could not identify the source of the missile, and so they went into this whole process of how do we react? The other aspect of this, which I think should be brought up, is the growing potential for nuclear proliferation. Some of the signals that the administration has been sending to NATO is that, well, we're not quite sure we'll come to your defense. And there's been discussion in Great Britain has nuclear power, but in Germany and France that maybe they need their own missiles. That is very destabilizing. And you've got other countries around the world that are considering that right now. So, and what we have to do is not only improve our failsafe, but actively re-engage in diplomacy to establish controls on nuclear weapons, as we were doing practically every administration up until this one. So it's a combination of really enhanced diplomacy and also establishing communication and warning system so that we're not surprised and we can react more thoughtfully.
So, Senator, last bonus question for you. At the end of the movie, they all repair to the Presidential Emergency Operations Center, the bunker, right, which is supposed to protect people from any strikes. That bunker happens to have been located underneath the East Wing, which the president has just destroyed. So what is the status of the presidential bunker that was underneath the part of the White House that has been pulverized?
I'll be very honest, I don't know. I've never been in the bunker. I've done some of these exercises, which they do on a regular basis, but in the Department of Defense. My presumption, though, is the bunker is very deeply buried, and that might allow them to do the construction. But again, I honestly don't know what the status is.
Well, we have been very focused on this question at Spy Talk, and were you to ask a few questions of the authorities that be that gets us an answer, we will definitely want to have you back to discuss it. But I really want to thank you for a really thoughtful discussion on major issues of interest to us. So thank you very much, Senator.
And good luck getting the information that you keep asking for.
Oh, no.
I'm really good luck with that. Yeah.
Thank you, Senator.
No, I do. Thank you all very much. And keep it up.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses from the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk, and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Jeff Stein.
I'm Michael Isikoff.
I'm Karen Greenberg.
Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to SpyTalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. MSW Media.
I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
It's Sunday morning, and that wonderfully relaxed feeling of a long, lazy day lingers in the air. If you want to make the moment last, may I suggest the perfect solution? The Martin Sheen Podcast. Join me, your host, Martin Sheen, for beautifully crafted 20-minute programs filled with never-before-heard stories of my life, along with personal reflections and poetry that inspires. The Martin Sheen Podcast is the perfect Sunday refresh, a chance to take a deep breath, relax, and know that the stress of Monday may be just around the corner, but not here, not now. So make this your weekly moment of calm as we explore faith, hope, love, and what it means to be human. And know this, this journey is ever unfolding as I invite you to see what's next with me, Martin Sheen, and thank you.